Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, February 5th. Stocks resume their rise after stumbling the week before when Egypt's revolution took hold. For the most part this past week, the focus was on fundamentals, which were strong, particularly on the manufacturing end, with the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index for January coming in at 68.8. the best since 1988, and the national ISM reading on manufacturing registering 60.8, its best since May 2004, both being way above the 50 dividing line between contraction and growth and continuing positive trends in this regard. December factory orders were up when a slight decline was forecast. And then the personal consumption figure for December was up a better-than-expected 0.7%, which was later confirmed by continuing solid gains in the latest same-store sales figures for chain stores, up some 4.9%. The only number that was disappointing was construction spending for December, which was down a solid 2.5% when an increase was expected, but this was attributable to a still sick housing market and dismal weather. Oh, but there was one other number that disappointed, or did it? The January report on employment showed a pathetic increase of just 36,000 jobs and an equally pathetic increase of 50,000 in the private sector. The consensus was for over 100,000 more than this. So since we're told that we need to generate more than 150,000 jobs a month to begin to make a dent in unemployment, and instead we've had far less than this each of the last 2 months, how is it then that the jobless rate has plummeted from 9.8% to 9% during that time? The easy answer is that hundreds of thousands are dropping out of the labor force, giving up. It's nuts. But imagine if this seeming chicanery continues into 2012, and let's say the jobless rate is 7.5% come that November, with most agreeing the figure is nowhere near a true reflection of the labor picture. Can you picture the uproar that would then ensue as conspiracy theorists, of which I might be one myself at that point, talk of attempts to rig the election? Alas, we don't have to deal with the issue in this format for quite a while, and we all should hope that legitimately the unemployment rate is something like 7.5% in less than 2 years. That would be positive on so many different levels, including the fact that the Federal Reserve would finally be raising interest rates to give savers the break they have long deserved. Of course, that would also mean that bond fund holders would be getting crushed, at least of the Treasury variety. But while we look at the crazy jobs number again, there was a lot to like this week, including one figure contained in the employment report, hourly earnings, which were up a solid 0.4% in January. This is good. We want rising wages, though also this week the Department of Labor said labor costs declined for a fifth quarter in six and were down 1.5% for all of 2010 versus a decline of 1.6% in 2009. Which brings us to the topic of inflation. Lots of talk on this front owing to soaring food costs. Though for all the hue and cry over commodities, the CRB index, a broad-based barometer of everything from wheat to oil, is up just 1.8% this year. Commodities corrected sharply at week's end as no doubt some speculators sold their positions, including oil traders on talk that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was about to leave, thus taking some of the risk premium out of the oil trade. Here's what I've been talking about this far in 2011. I believe that the spike we are seeing in food prices is partially warranted, not wholly because of ever-present speculation, due to rising demand in the third world as more and more move into the middle class. This latter part is good. Compounding matters, however, is the hoarding now taking place in North Africa and the Middle East as governments scramble to ensure they have foodstuffs to meet the needs of an increasingly disgruntled populace. This is not good, especially after the plethora of weather disturbances we've seen around the world the past year. One worrisome development that will increasingly take center stage is the catastrophic drought in northern China. Imagine Beijing and the surrounding area hasn't seen any precipitation in 100 to 120 days. The counted on winter wheat crop is dead. On the sugar front, much of the world's production comes from northeastern Australia, Queensland, and the sugar and banana crops were just devastated by the strongest storm to ever hit the continent, Cyclone Yasi. Incredibly, the death toll appears to be just 3 as I go to post, but the destruction is massive, including from the remnants of the storm that jogged south and did a number on Melbourne. On a personal note, while the major city of Cairns was spared a direct hit, I was just there last October and I closely followed the evacuation plans. The authorities did a great job of preparing the people for the worst. But here's my bottom line on food prices. Despite the weather issues, I do not believe the world is running out of food, and I believe by May we will receive much better news on the global harvest front. If we have another severe weather year, however, including zero rain in northern China and another drought in Russia, then we might as well all give up. What I've been saying, though, is that the spike in inflation will slow the global economy, whether it is rising wheat or oil, and we are increasingly hearing of corporations taking a hit when it comes to profit margins. So the combination of shrinking margins and a slowing global outlook means equity markets could struggle versus expectations. Food prices will then drop. Throw in geopolitical uncertainty and you end up in the United States with a down year for stocks, though not significantly so. That was my prediction at year-end in December when looking at 2011, and you know I stick to my forecast unless we're invaded by aliens next Tuesday, which would indeed be a game changer for all of us. I've been talking of a European economy, for example, that needs to grow at 4% to stabilize its debt issue, but the forecast is for growth below 2% this year, downright putrid, especially if you take out Germany and, to a lesser extent, France when looking at the entire Eurozone. The IMF's chief economist said this week that, quote, growth remains disturbingly biased toward Germany. Every single Eurozone figure on manufacturing and the service sector shows Germany leading the way, with many others struggling big time. It can't continue this way because we already know the German people have had enough with bailing out their weaker brethren. Speaking of the weak, Ireland's new government takes shape after early elections on February 25th, and it will immediately seek to renegotiate the terms of the $113 billion EU IMF bailout, at which point they will be given the finger, while Spain's finance minister and other government officials continue to try and convince all who will listen that despite 20% unemployment, the country is in great shape. Our savings banks, you ask? No problem. Forget those estimates for needed capital infusions ranging up to $130 billion. And then we have the various austerity programs that are being enacted. I hope they work with minimal disruption in terms of public outcry, but that's not likely. I've been telling you of April 27 in Britain, for example, as being a day of planned labor unrest right before the royal wedding. How many more countries in Europe and perhaps elsewhere will use the traditional May Day time frame to voice their concerns? Will governments then cave? Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz said this week that many European countries are pursuing, quote, excessive austerity, risking a marked slowdown in growth. Stiglitz said, there's this disastrous policy that even in the countries that don't need to have austerity, they're going for much more excessive austerity than they need. He's referring to the UK. We are already seeing around Europe the consequences of this austerity. The clear implication is that growth will be slower. Well, that's been my pitch since last summer. Incidentally, I just booked a trip to Paris this spring. A weekend book ended around May Day. I will be totally prepared for a bit of chaos, including strikes of all kinds. But let's turn our attention to the U.S. budget deficit and national debt. Last week I wrote President Obama's State of the Union was an unmitigated disaster for his failure to tackle the issue. The next day, Sunday, the Washington Post ran the following editorial. In his State of the Union address, President Obama failed to present a credible plan for long-term debt reduction. The president took a cagier route. He hailed the Bipartisan Deficit Commission's important progress without endorsing any of its recommendations. He acknowledged that the government will have to raise taxes, but said it in such a convoluted way that no one could possibly understand. He pledged a willingness to reform Social Security, but without slashing benefits for future generations, phrasing that conceivably left him room to reduce benefits below some slash threshold known only to him, while sounding as though he opposes any cuts at all. What could explain such cynicism? One theory would be that Mr. Obama doesn't agree about the seriousness of the problem. If this is so, his rhetoric 2 years ago, he warned, "We can no longer afford to leave the hard choices for the next budget, the next administration, or the next generation." And on Tuesday, he reiterated, "Now the final step, a critical step in winning the future, is to make sure we aren't buried under a mountain of debt." Is just that, rhetoric. But the arithmetic is so clear, and mainstream economists are so in agreement, that it seems unlikely that Mr. Obama would be a secret dissenter. Washington Post continues, "The second possibility is that he calculated the chances of getting a deal at close to zero. The third and scariest possibility is this. The White House may have decided that debt reduction is so tough it has to await what officials, speaking not for attribution, have termed a, quote, forcing event. A spike in interest rates, or reluctance by foreigners to buy U.S. debt, or some other market disruption that would frighten Congress into action. What's disturbing about this idea is that such forcing events tend to take on lives of their own. Once a panic starts, it's not easily controlled." It's not too late for Mr. Obama to apply a different kind of forcing event, presidential leadership. We understand it's tough. Americans say they want deficit reduction, but they oppose just about every kind of tax hike or spending cut needed to make deficit reduction happen. But they also are genuinely worried about the debt and the European example. Candor instead of caginess might yield results. That was an editorial from the Washington Post. Morgan Stanley Stephen Roach issued a warning on the U.S. dollar front, which is tied to the discussion on deficit reduction. In the next 3 or 5 years, China will move aggressively to increase its private consumption and reduce its surplus saving. The U.S. talks the talk, but there is actually no shred of evidence whatsoever that America is going to reduce its budget deficit over that same period. So, China may post a trade deficit as early as this quarter, imports outpacing exports, which will remove a key incentive for China to support the dollar, all while the U.S. budget deficit will hit $1.5 trillion this year. If we don't move to address our deficit before China addresses its surplus, then we are going to be facing some pretty significant external funding constraints, Roach adds. That would lead to a significant downward pressure on the dollar and or higher long-term U.S. interest rates. It's a mess. But I'll leave you with a final thought, and it concerns the terror threat. This week we had a slew of warnings, the U.S. warning about taking public transportation in London, an apparent al-Qaeda in Yemen threat against Wall Street executives, and the release of WikiLeaks cables discussing the government's concern that al-Qaeda is vigorously pursuing the ability to unleash dirty bomb attacks, among others. I said a little about the Chechen terrorist bombing of the Moscow airport because it frankly doesn't impact our financial markets. But the same act taking place in New York, London, or Paris most definitely would, and ditto a dirty bomb in one of these three. It's beyond belief we can continue to be so lucky. I'm not so sure how well the American people will handle it. Stocks staged their broadest rally since the first week of December, with the Dow Jones up 2.3% to 12,092, the S&P up 2.7%, and NASDAQ advancing 3.1% to 2769. The S&P has now risen 94% from its March 2009 low, the biggest rally over equivalent time period since 1936. Bonds tanked and yields rose to 9-month highs for a variety of reasons, including food inflation fears and the strong economic news, with a focus not on the actual pitiful job gains, but rather the rapid decline in the unemployment rate. Should the economy prove to be as strong as the manufacturing data is foretelling, then the Fed will have to begin to tighten sooner than currently forecast. So say some in the bond pits. The European Central Bank held the line on its own key interest rate yet again, even as Eurozone inflation for the month of January remains above its 2% preferred target, 2.4%. The ECB, though, like the Federal Reserve, is sanguine on the inflation picture despite what it sees as short-term pressures. Meanwhile, the Euro 17 nations disagreed on some major issues, Germany and France versus the rest, basically, as German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy unveiled their plan for a binding Euro-wide agreement on pension, tax, and labor policies that would interfere with existing initiatives. For example, Germany and France don't want to see any more wage pacts pegged to the inflation rate, whereupon the likes of Belgium countered, "We will not allow our social model to be undone." So the Eurozone continues to have stark differences that, unless resolved, will continue to lead to bouts of severe uncertainty and financial stress. That's all for this week. I have a ton of information on the crisis in Egypt at stocksnews.com. Click on Weekend Review. I'll be back with you next Saturday. Have a good week, and take care.